Thank you guys for joining this press call hosted by Beckett to discuss upcoming religious freedom cases at the Supreme Court. We'd also like to thank the Aspen Institute's Inclusive America Project and the Faith Angle Forum for co-hosting this call. Beckett President Mark Ranzi will start with discussing the themes for the upcoming Supreme Court term, followed by Beckett's Vice President and Senior Counsel Lou Goodrich, who will discuss the cases being heard at the court this term. And then last but not least, Beckett's Senior Counsel Lori Windham will preview petitions that are pending before the court. We will field submitted questions throughout the call and we'll stop between each section of the agenda and have the relevant attorney answer those questions. Again, we ask that everyone remain on mute. If your questions are not answered, please email media@beckettlaw.org. Mark, go ahead and take away.
Great. Thank you very much, Ryan. Thank you and welcome to everybody. And my apologies for the fire alarm-induced delay. This is shaping up to be an exciting term for religious liberty, and we appreciate that you all are taking a few minutes to get the scoop on what is coming down the pike. I think this term will see the court have some opportunities to tighten up and improve its doctrine, and in the process perhaps stem the tide of religious liberty cases it's been getting in recent years by giving some clear answers and some clear resolutions to some lingering controversies. I think it's best to think about this term first by thinking about what we saw at the end of the last term on religious liberty. Toward the end of the term, we got the court's decision in the American Legion case over the Bladensburg World War I cross. And there we saw a pretty strong majority of the court's seven justices say that keeping the cross up doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. And the way in which they said it and the arguments that they used for the resolution they reached, I think, are important and I think signal where this court is headed on religious liberty. The justices emphasized that the point of the religion clauses is to foster a society in which people of all beliefs can live together harmoniously. And the justices explained that using the Constitution to force people to tear down a memorial cross would strike people as aggressively hostile to religion and wouldn't be doing the work that the First Amendment is supposed to do of finding a way for people of all range of different beliefs to live together harmoniously. So you saw the court expressing a concern about the use of its own doctrine to lead not to, you know, people of different beliefs living together harmoniously, but to sort of aggressive conflicts, and the court was acting to fix that. That was the only merits religious liberty case the court decided last term. Religious liberty did show up on what's often called the court's shadow docket a couple times. That's where the justices give short opinions in cert petitions or applications and so forth. And I'll just highlight one that I think will have some particular salience for this upcoming term. In a case called Kennedy versus Bremerton, there was an opinion by Justice Alito, but then joined by Justices Thomas, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, that pointed to two older cases that have caused some difficulty in the court's doctrine. One, Employment Division versus Smith, which had a sort of strained reading of the Free Exercise Clause, and one, TWA versus Hardison, which gave a narrow reading to the protection for religious employees under Title VII. Particularly about Smith, those four justices said that Smith had, quote, drastically cut back on the protection provided by the Free Exercise Clause, but they pointed out that the particular case in front of them last year hadn't presented a challenge to Smith or a request to revisit Smith. And so four justices seemed to pretty clearly be indicating that they saw that decision as at least somewhat problematic and worth considering revisiting. As the court turns to this term, I think we're likely to see a shift from last year there being a focus on the Establishment Clause with the court case to this year. I think much more attention is likely on the Free Exercise case, on the Free Exercise Clause. One case in particular dealing with free exercise issues is the Espinoza case coming out of Montana. And that deals not only with the Free Exercise Clause, but also with a lingering issue that the court addressed a little bit a couple of years ago in the Trinity Lutheran case, which is state constitutional amendments, often called Blaine Amendments, that single out religious actors and religious institutions and say they can't participate in certain government programs on equal footing with everybody else. Espinoza is a possibility for the court to deal with that issue once again. That they touched on a little bit in Trinity Lutheran. Also coming down the pike in cert petitions, there are several cases that do raise challenges to Employment Division versus Smith, which, again, those four justices last year seemed to express some interest in. One is called Ricks, about a gentleman in Idaho who, for religious reasons, can't use his Social Security number to get a contractor's license, even though he's willing to give many other methods of identification. And one called Fulton v. Philadelphia, over whether the city of Philadelphia can stop Catholic charities from participating in foster and adoption care. There's also a challenge to TWA versus Hardison, the other case that the justice has mentioned in that opinion, called Patterson v. Walgreens coming. And I think you will also see a likelihood of seeing some additional consideration by the court on some of the issues left open from the Obergefell same-sex marriage decision a few years ago and the Masterpiece Cake decision from a year plus ago. In that Obergefell, Chief Justice Roberts had specifically noted that, well, soon enough, we're going to have to deal with religious foster and adoption agencies who, for religious reasons, can't work with, can't do home studies and approve of same-sex couples as adoptive houses. That's back in Fulton. And also just the whole wedding vendor issue that was at issue in Masterpiece may be back with the Arlene Flowers case. Last batch of kind of returning cases that we're likely to see before I turn it over to people to do the detailed review, the ministerial exception, which the court addressed unanimously back in 2011-2012 in the Hosanna-Tabor case. There's a couple of cases coming out of the Ninth Circuit. Most of the circuits seem to have treated the court's Hosanna-Tabor decision as pretty clear in how you figure out if somebody is a minister, such that the church gets to choose who can teach children the faith. But as sometimes happens, the Ninth Circuit seems to have gone its own way on this in three or four recent cases, and other circuits have started pointing it out, and that's also headed back to the court. So I think all of these cases give the court a chance to revisit some lingering open issues in its doctrine. And I think from the court's point of view, they probably also provide the opportunity to give some firmer and hopefully closer to final answers to longstanding controversies. And I guess the last one that is on that list, which I shouldn't leave out, is the contraceptive mandate issue. The Little Sisters of the Poor remain in court, this time fighting against state governments that are suing to say that the federal government can't give them an exception from the contraceptive mandate. So this is an issue that's been to the court several times before. A few years ago, right after Justice Scalia's death, the court didn't fully resolve it, but I think sent it back to the lower courts and suggested that the parties ought to find a way to resolve the case among themselves. They did, but now states are unhappy with it, and that's coming back. So I think on all these fronts, what we've got are situations where the court has left things somewhat open-ended in the past and hasn't fully resolved or drilled down the doctrine. The result has been continued turmoil in the lower courts and continued discord without clear answers. And I think the court has, if last year's American Legion decision is any guide, I think the court is open to finding ways where it needs to make clear that its doctrine shouldn't be causing those types of troubles, and instead that the First Amendment should function as it's supposed to, which is as a way to let people live together harmoniously, even though they have different views. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Luke Goodrich, who is going to run through the key cases that the court has already granted cert on, so it's already decided to hear.
Luke? Thanks, Mark. Before we do that, I just want to give a second if anybody has any questions for you about the themes going on at the court. You can email media@beckettlaw.org, and we will answer those. We don't have any questions right now. I just want to give a second just in case anyone does, and then I will turn it over to Luke.
And Mark, this is Luke, and actually just to kick off the questions, you know, I think some folks might be wondering, are we anticipating that this is going to be a huge term in terms of religious freedom, relatively quiet term? Sort of what's your expectation going forward?
My expectation is a pretty big term. There's a possibility they could grant cert on some of these things late, so some of these issues might show up in the following term. But I actually can't recall a time in the last 20 years that there were this many key issues that seemed ready for decision and primed for decision and a court that seems open to them. So I think it's likely to be a very big term. My real prediction is big term followed then by some small terms, because if the court actually resolves these lingering issues that keep coming up to it, it can kind of clear the decks and give people some firm rules, and then it will not have to deal with these questions quite as often after this term or this term and next.
Thanks, Mark. So we don't have any questions for you. We could turn this over to you, Luke, to discuss the case of being heard for the court this term.
Great. Thanks, Ryan. So I get the privilege of talking about two big cases the court has already agreed to hear. One is called Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. That's about a state scholarship program that enables low-income families to send their children to religious or non-religious private schools. And then the second case is actually a trio of cases, commonly known as Bostock, Altitude Express, and Harris Funeral Homes. And those cases involve the scope of federal employment discrimination laws, and in particular, whether federal law prohibits employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. So for each case, I'll just give a very brief overview of the facts and the key legal issues, and then say a few words about the significance of the case for religious liberty. So first, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. In 2015, the Montana legislature enacted a scholarship program for K through 12 students. And the way that program worked was pretty simple. Any citizen could donate up to $150 to a private nonprofit scholarship organization and get a dollar for dollar reduction of their tax liability. These private scholarship organizations would then use that money to provide scholarships so children could attend any qualified school in the state, including religious or non-religious private schools. So the bottom line is, this is a program that helps low-income families send their children to private schools. This program is perfectly permissible under the federal constitution. That's undisputed. There's a case called Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, where the Supreme Court upheld these kinds of programs against federal constitutional challenges. But the issue in this case is a state constitutional amendment. Montana has a constitutional amendment in its state constitution that goes further than the federal establishment clause. It prohibits the government from making any direct or indirect appropriation of public funds, quote, for any sectarian purpose, unquote. This state constitutional amendment is commonly known as a Blaine Amendment. There are roughly 37 to 39 states that have these kinds of amendments. And so they're a key issue in the case. So the Montana Department of Revenue got this new statute, new program, scholarship program, looked at the program, looked at the state constitutional amendment and said, hey, we can't, under state law, allow any of this scholarship money to be used at religious schools. So it issued a regulation saying that scholarship money under these programs could only be used at secular schools. And that is what prompted this lawsuit. Several low-income single mothers sued the state, saying that taking away their scholarship money solely because they chose religious schools was illegal. The trial court in Montana ruled in favor of the mothers, but then the Montana Supreme Court reversed. It said that the state Blaine Amendment was very strict, wouldn't allow any of this money to flow to religious schools. But the state Supreme Court also said it couldn't sort of judicially fix the scholarship program by eliminating the scholarships only for religious schools. So it struck down the entire scholarship program for private schools. So none of the money can be used at religious private schools or secular private schools. And now the case has gone up to the Supreme Court. So what are the key legal issues here? There are three basic things you need to understand this case. One is just a little bit of history and background on these Blaine Amendments, because that's a very core issue in the case. Blaine Amendments have their origin in the mid to late 1800s. Just a very quick thumbnail sketch of the history. So in the mid to late 1800s, the public schools were largely Protestant. There were daily Bible readings from the King James Bible. Students were required to recite Protestant prayers. But also at that time, you had an influx of Catholic immigrants, and they objected to sending their children to heavily Protestant public schools, and they sought funding for a separate system of Catholic schools. Long story short, this ultimately led to outrage among many Protestants who deemed Catholic schools to be quote unquote sectarian. There were riots, Catholic buildings were burned down, Catholic children were expelled from the public schools, and a man named James Blaine, representative from Maine, proposed a federal constitutional amendment that would bar funding for quote unquote sectarian schools. And everybody knew that sectarian was code for Catholic. This constitutional amendment failed narrowly at the federal level, but many states adopted their own Blaine amendments. Montana was no exception. There was heavy anti-Catholic sentiment in Montana in the late 1800s, and that ultimately produced the Blaine Amendment. So a big question in the case, in the Supreme Court in Espinoza, is what is the court going to do with Montana's Blaine Amendment? What is it going to do with Blaine Amendments possibly in 37 other states? What is the court going to do when it looks at this history that was clearly and concededly anti-Catholic? Is that going to influence the ruling in this case? A second thing you need to understand is just a little bit about the existing precedent governing the case. So Mark mentioned earlier the Trinity Lutheran case, decided just a couple terms ago. That was another Blaine-related case where the state of Missouri had a program that would award grants so that schools and other entities could replace the surfacing of their playgrounds with shredded tires. And Missouri awarded grants to a variety of entities, but said it wouldn't award a grant to a Lutheran daycare. And the Supreme Court ultimately struck that down, said that Missouri violated the federal free exercise clause by eliminating a government benefit based on the religious status of the recipient. So Trinity Lutheran will be a key case at issue here. And then the third legal issue to understand is kind of the somewhat unusual procedural posture of the case, in that the Montana Supreme Court, it didn't just strike down scholarship funds for religious schools, it struck down the scholarship funds going to any private school. This is called leveling down. Sort of, if we're worried about money going to religious schools, let's just strike the whole program down. And so one of the main arguments from the state of Montana in this case is, hey, we're not discriminating against religious schools. We eliminated the program entirely, and nothing in the Constitution can force us to maintain a scholarship program that we don't want to maintain. So those are the key legal issues in the case. So the significance of the case for religious liberty is, number one, this could have a huge impact on Blaine amendments nationwide. And this is not just about scholarships and vouchers for private schools. Blaine amendments have affected a wide variety of government programs, such as historic preservation grants, where local governments give out funds to repair historic buildings, which may include churches. It also affects social services, where we had a case a few years ago involving a prisoner reentry program, where the government funded a wide variety of programs that would help prisoners reenter society. And under a state Blaine Amendment, the state court struck down, or at one point struck down, a program that would have, a religious program that was helping prisoners reenter society. So these Blaine Amendments have a huge effect on the relationship between church and state in a wide variety of contexts. The other big issue for religious liberty is what the court is going to do with Trinity Lutheran and its earlier case called Locke versus Davie. Basically, this case could have a huge impact on the relationship between church and state, particularly when it comes to funding and the extent to which government funds can flow to both religious and non-religious entities on neutral terms. And then finally, the big question lingering in the case is the issue of leveling down. If the government eliminates the program entirely, does that cure the potential constitutional violation? If so, that could make this case quite a bit narrower, less significant, but it's a big issue. It comes up not only in funding cases, but in religious land use cases, in prisoner cases, and it's a significant issue for religious liberty going forward. So that's kind of a brief overview of Espinoza, and I'll be happy to take your questions after I address the second case. So the second case, as I mentioned, is a trio of cases: Bostock, Altitude Express, and Harris Funeral Homes. And in all three cases, these involve employees who claim that they lost their job either because of their sexual orientation or their gender identity. And they filed suit under Title VII, which is the federal law that prohibits employment discrimination. And so the question in front of the Supreme Court right now is, Title VII doesn't explicitly prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, but it does prohibit discrimination based on sex. So the question is whether firing someone because of their sexual orientation or gender identity is a form of discrimination based on sex. Now, from roughly 1979 to 2017, a period of 38 years, all 11 courts of appeals to address this question held that Title VII doesn't prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. But in 2017, the Seventh Circuit departed from this consensus, and so did the Second Circuit in the Altitude Express case. And so now the question has landed at the Supreme Court. The basic argument of the LGBT employees is that you can't discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity without somehow taking the employee's sex into account. That is, if you, for example, if you fire males who are attracted to males, but you don't fire females who are attracted to males, you are inherently taking the employee's sex into account and have accordingly discriminated based on sex. In response, the employers and the federal government in this case argue that you're not discriminating based on sex merely when you take sex into account. You're discriminating based on sex only if you disadvantage one sex when compared with the other. So, for example, if an employer fires males who are attracted to males and also fires females who are attracted to females, it is disadvantaging LGBT employees compared to straight employees, which is discriminating based on sexual orientation, but it is not disadvantaging females compared with males or vice versa, so it's not engaged in discrimination based on sex. The federal government also draws an analogy to sex-specific bathrooms and dress codes, where if you say, for example, men can't use women's restrooms and women can't use men's restrooms, yes, you've taken sex into account, but you haven't discriminated based on sex because you haven't disadvantaged one sex when compared with the other. Now, what does all of this have to do with religious liberty? Many religious organizations have long-standing beliefs about human sexuality, and they often expect their employees to live in accordance with those beliefs. So, for example, they expect their employees to refrain from sex outside of traditional marriage, and they expect their employees to live in accordance with their biological sex. So if Title VII, if the Supreme Court interprets Title VII the way it was interpreted for the first 40 to 50 years, these religious organizations are in the clear. They are allowed to expect their employees to adhere to their religious beliefs. But if the Supreme Court expands the scope of Title VII and agrees that discriminating based on sexual orientation or gender identity is an illegal form of sex discrimination, all of a sudden, all of these religious organizations will be exposed to new lawsuits and potentially massive liability. This applies to churches, to religious schools, religious social service providers, basically any religious organization that expects its employees to follow their religious standards of conduct could face new liability. Now, Title VII, there are some religious exemptions that could potentially reduce the scope of this conflict. One is the ministerial exception, which bars lawsuits by employees who perform important religious functions. And a second exemption is in a provision of Title VII, a statutory exemption that says religious organizations can hire persons of the same religion to carry out their work. But the scope of both of these exemptions, the ministerial exception and the Title VII religious exemption, the scope is hotly contested in court. And so no matter how those exemptions ultimately end up getting interpreted, an expansion of the scope of Title VII is going to create massive church-state conflict. And we lay this out in our amicus brief, which we filed on behalf of the National Association of Evangelicals, American Islamic Congress, the LDS Church, Jewish groups, and Eastern Orthodox groups. One of the main points of our brief is that it doesn't have to end like this. There are actually, and you can see this by looking at state law. There are 22 states right now, plus the District of Columbia, that have adopted legislation prohibiting employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And all 22 states and the District of Columbia have religious exemptions to those laws. And 3/4 of those states have exemptions that are broader than Title VII's religious exemption. Some of the states exempt religious organizations from their employment discrimination laws entirely. Other states exempt religious organizations from the bans on sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. And so the bottom line is, when this type of expansion of the law is done legislatively rather than by judicial fiat, legislatures can strike a balance between expanding protections for sexual orientation and gender identity and protecting religious liberty. And so that's what we have asked the court to do there, is create space for legislatures, for the legislature to resolve this issue. And as Mark said, to allow people of different beliefs to live together in society harmoniously. So with that, I'll just open it up to questions.
Thanks, Luke. So people that joined late, that was Becca VP and Senior Counsel Luke Goodrich. We will now be fielding questions for Luke. Please email media@beckettlaw.org. We will take your questions. We have one from Nicole Russell of Washington Examiner. The question is, what's your sense in the Harris Funeral Homes case that the court will actually address the heart of the issue, which is, what is gender and who has the right to define it? The court has had a chance to address the larger free speech issue in Masterpiece and instead ruled narrowly. What are the chances they'll do this again?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, as I read the briefs, they very clearly present a big issue of statutory interpretation. And that's really what this case is about, is how should the justices go about interpreting statutory text, and particularly the term sex. And I really don't see a way for the court to address the issue narrowly. It's sort of a yes or no question. Are claims of discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity subsumed within the category of discrimination based on sex, or are they not? And it's a hard question. There's a lot of different ways of reaching an answer, but I don't really see a way that the court can dodge or rule really narrowly on this one. And I think we will get a definitive answer.
Great. Thanks, Luke. The second question we have from Raphael Hoffman of Homodia. The question is, the most significant religious liberty issue justices will likely rule on this term will revolve around the role and definitions of gender and identity orientation in workplace discrimination law. One of the key claims made by religious objectors is that the questions asked in this case must be addressed by Congress, not the courts. If religious liberty interests are victorious in the court ruling, do you fear that it will lead to more urgent calls from those on the left for Congress to indeed address these issues with passage of the Equality Act, which most agree would have disastrous consequences for many religious organizations and employers? In essence, could even a win at the court spell a greater loss for religious liberty not far down the road?
Yeah, that's another great question. And I wish I had the crystal ball that would allow me to give the answer with certainty. But yeah, no doubt, I think a ruling that sex is limited to the biological categories of male and female and doesn't include discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, I think that type of ruling would increase calls for legislation like the Equality Act. As far as how that plays out, I really don't know. The one thing I would point to, though, is the history of how this has played out in the 22 states and the District of Columbia that have enacted these kinds of laws legislatively. And some of those states enacted their laws after a ruling like the one I just described, where a state court said, no, our law doesn't extend to sexual orientation or gender identity. And then the state legislature responded and enacted new protections for sexual orientation and gender identity. But again, in all 22 states and the District of Columbia that have enacted this kind of legislation, there are very significant religious exemptions, often even broader than what is currently in Title VII. And even as late as 2014, groups like Human Rights Campaign, Lambda Legal, ACLU, when they were pushing for this kind of legislation in Congress, typically under the Employment Non-Discrimination Act was the title of the law. All of those groups, until 2014, supported very broad religious exemptions to the type of law that would prohibit employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. The Equality Act doesn't currently have that, but the question would be, could it pass without that? And I think that would be a very steep uphill climb. And it, particularly when only just a few years ago, even the most vehement proponents of LGBT protections agreed that there should be broad religious exemptions.
Great, thanks, Luke. So we've got another question from Paul Strand from Christian Broadcast Network. His question is, Luke, you said people could donate up to $150 to a scholarship fund. Is $150 a correct number? Seems a little low.
Yeah, it is the correct number. It is low. There are some states that have a higher cap, but I think the way to look at this, it was sort of a tentative experiment from the Montana legislature, something they hadn't done before. There was actually also a provision in the law, a sunset provision. So the scholarship program would automatically die out some years hence, unless it were expressly renewed by the legislature. So it was a very modest program, but I think the idea was if you had enough people making these $150 donations, you would eventually get a pool of money that was enough to make a significant difference in granting scholarships.
Great, thank you. We've got another one from Chris Johnson of the Washington Blade. His question is, could there be a middle ground in Title VII cases if SCOTUS ruled for LGBT inclusive of the law, but also took up Fulton petition to expand religious exemptions for employers?
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility that the court could take both cases, or, you know, even if it didn't take Fulton, you could imagine a world where Title VII is expanded in Bostock, Altitude Express, and Harris Funeral Homes. And then, you know, you have this massive increase in litigation for religious organizations, lots of church-state conflict, and the issue would eventually percolate up to the Supreme Court. And I think the Supreme Court would be forced to weigh in, both on the ministerial exception and on the scope of the Title VII religious exemption. And you could imagine a ruling by the Supreme Court that would broadly protect the rights of religious organizations to require their employees to adhere to their religious standards of conduct. So certainly that's, you know, it's possible to get both types of protections from the Supreme Court over the long term, but not without a lot of litigation and a lot of church-state conflict in the meantime. And what you've seen in the states, again, the 22 states and the District of Columbia, is they've enacted broader religious exemptions than are currently in federal law.
Great, thanks, Luke. That was the last question that we had in the media inbox. Again, if anyone has any questions for Luke, please email media@beckettlaw.org. We'll wait a few moments and we will give it over to Lori for the final comments. We do have one more question from Mark Sherman of the Associated Press. Let's see, what's your sense, and how is that it? Sorry, yeah, Mark Sherman from the Associated Press. Why hasn't there been a push to repeal the state Blaine amendments?
There actually has been a push. It's been more at a state-by-state level. And you know, I don't know if Lori or Mark may recall better than I, but at least a few years ago, a couple states have actually repealed their Blaine amendments. They've acknowledged that they're rooted in anti-Catholic bigotry, unnecessary, and they've repealed them. Other states have entertained repeal. Florida a few years ago, I think, had a ballot initiative that failed. I think Oklahoma a few years ago had a ballot initiative to repeal the Blaine Amendment, and that failed. You often have public school related organizations, teachers unions are often vehemently opposed to repeal of Blaine because they would allow more room for voucher and scholarship programs. So it's not always easy to repeal at the state level. It has been done. It has also been tried and sometimes failed. But if Mark and Lori remember off the top of your head any of the other repeal efforts, feel free to chime in.
Luke, I'd mention in addition to that, not repeal efforts, but some state Supreme Courts, as you touched on with the Florida case, have limited the scope of their state Blaine amendments, which I think removes some of that pressure to repeal. Indiana is one such state, and Florida is another. There was a lower appellate court. But sometimes when you have state courts that are weighing in to limit the discriminatory impact of the state Blaine amendments, I think that also takes some of the pressure off for repeal efforts.
Yeah, that's a great point, Lori. And often how that is done, you've had some cases where a state will enact a scholarship program or a voucher program. Groups that oppose the voucher program will sue under the state Blaine Amendment, saying, hey, this violates, you know, our state constitution says no money can go to a sectarian purpose. And then the case goes up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court interprets its Blaine Amendment narrowly and says, well, this prohibits like a direct grant of government funds to a religious school, but this voucher program, this scholarship program, this is just indirect aid. It's really the private families that are making the decision to use these funds at religious schools. So our state Blaine Amendment is not implicated here. And sometimes those rulings have narrowed Blaine's enough that they don't do as much harm and there isn't as much need for repeal.
Thank you, Luke. So we got one last question, then I will turn it over to Lori. So this is Samuel Lelimo from the Religious Freedom Institute. Can you speak to the role Price v. Waterhouse will play in the upcoming trio of Title VII cases?
Sure. So Price versus Waterhouse is a landmark Supreme Court case interpreting Title VII and dealing with the issue of sex stereotyping. And so one of the arguments that the LGBT employees are making in the case is that by firing an employee who is in a same-sex marriage or who is struggling with gender identity, you're imposing a sex stereotype. You're imposing the stereotype that men should only be attracted to women, and women should only be attracted to men, or that men should dress a certain way and act a certain way, women should dress a certain way and act a certain way. And their argument is that under Price Waterhouse, that this is the employer's acting on sex stereotyping, which is an independent violation of Title VII. The response to that argument by the employees, by the employers and by the federal government is that sex stereotyping is not an independent violation of Title VII. It's only evidence of sex discrimination. So if a sex stereotype doesn't disadvantage one sex with respect to the other, then it's not a violation of Title VII. And in Price Waterhouse itself, it was a female employee. The employer argued that she was acting too aggressively, basically too macho, and therefore denied her a promotion. And the court said this basically put women in a catch-22. If they were passive and submissive, they wouldn't get a promotion. And if they were more aggressive, they wouldn't get a promotion because they were deemed to be too macho. So it was a sex stereotype that worked to the disadvantage of one particular sex. When it comes to sexual orientation or gender identity, when an employer is applying its policy in an even-handed way, whatever the sex stereotype may be, it's not disadvantaging men vis-a-vis women or women vis-a-vis men, and therefore it's not a violation of Price Waterhouse. So those are the two arguments on either side.
Thanks, Luke. We'll turn over now, finally, to Beckett Senior Counsel Lori Windham, and she will preview the petitions that are pending before the court. Lori, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you, Ryan, and thank you all for joining us this morning. I know we had a longer handout that went out to everybody on the call that gives you a synopsis of a bunch of different petitions to watch. I'm not going to try and hit every one of those on here because I think we'd be here for another hour if I did. But I do want to highlight a few issues, some that Mark and Luke have already touched on, that are really important religious liberty questions that the Supreme Court has already expressed some interest in. And so I know that we will certainly be watching, and I imagine many of you will want to be watching as well. Most of these are going to be considered by the court in conferences in November and December for a potential hearing in the spring. The first one I wanted to mention is Fulton v. City of Philadelphia. This is a case with major religious freedom implications, especially for foster and adoption agencies. We know that there is some interest at the court in this case because last year we filed an emergency petition seeking an injunction pending appeal from the Supreme Court. The 8-member court denied that petition, but three justices, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, noted their dissent, so they would have granted that emergency injunction for the Fulton plaintiffs. Indicates that the court is aware of this issue and has shown some interest in it already. This case, as Mark mentioned, involves Sharon L. Fulton, Tony Sims Bush, and Catholic Social Services of Philadelphia. Catholic Social Services is currently unable to place children in homes like Sharon L. Fulton's or homes of other families who are ready to welcome foster children. The City of Philadelphia is refusing to allow any more children to be placed with Catholic Social Services due to its dispute with the Archdiocese over their beliefs and policies regarding marriage. This started back in March of 2018 when, even though no same-sex couple had approached Catholic Social Services seeking an endorsement to become foster parents, there was a Philadelphia Inquirer article on this issue. Catholic Social Services acknowledged their policy that they would refer same-sex or unmarried couples to another agency. After that point, the City of Philadelphia stopped working with them. If the city succeeds, then Catholic Social Services will be excluded from providing foster care to children who are in Philadelphia's foster care system. Being able to partner with the city is the only way that agencies in Philadelphia are able to provide foster care to children who are in Philadelphia's child welfare system. The Third Circuit ruled against Ms. Fulton and Ms. Sims Bush and Catholic Social Services, determined that this was not a violation of the Supreme Court's decision in Masterpiece, even though there were some significant similarities in things city officials had said and done, determined that under the rule of Employment Division v. Smith, that there had been no free exercise clause violation, and also determined that there was no unconstitutional speech compulsion in that case, even though Catholic Social Services was being asked to provide home studies, making endorsements of couples for to become foster parents. We filed a cert petition in this case in July. The Supreme Court has called for has extended the time for response for Philadelphia and the interveners. So we are expecting to receive that response the first week in October, and we're expecting that the Supreme Court will be considering this case sometime probably in November to see whether it's going to grant that petition. Another case that has received a lot of attention and is not a Beckett case is Arlene Flowers v. Washington, the companion case of Arlene Flowers v. Ingersoll. This is a case involving Baronelle Stutzman, a floral artist who was unable to participate in a same-sex wedding. For that, she was sued and penalized heavily. by the state of Washington. The Supreme Court had this petition before it last term, or I should say in the October term 2017, when it decided the Masterpiece case. It sent the Arlene Flowers case back down to the Washington Supreme Court to reconsider their decision in light of the Masterpiece decision. Last year, or earlier this year, the Washington Supreme Court reconsidered that case, issued a new opinion which maintained the penalties for Ms. Stutzman and rejected her free exercise arguments. And so that case is now pending before the Supreme Court again. The cert petition was just filed last week, and so I expect that the Supreme Court will be considering later this fall whether it's going to take up Arlene Flowers' case. I want to turn next to a series of cases, and Mark mentioned this at the beginning, that involved the ministerial exception. The ministerial exception is a legal term of art. It's a class of cases in which the civil courts will not become involved because they are disputes between churches and their ministers. Minister too here is a legal term of art rather than a religious term. It refers to employees who serve important religious functions within a religious organization. This issue was last up before the court in the Hosanna-Tabor decision in 2012, where the unanimous Supreme Court upheld the ministerial exception as applied to a teacher at a religious school. Since then, most of the appellate courts and state Supreme Courts have applied Hosanna-Tabor to have used Hosanna-Tabor and applied it to employees who serve important religious functions. But we now have a circuit split and a state appellate court split on this question. This comes out of the Ninth Circuit, where there are two cases, Our Lady of Guadalupe v. Morrissey Beru and St. James v. Beale. In Our Lady of Guadalupe, the issue is a Catholic school teacher who's a catechist engaged in religious teaching and modeling religious activities for students at the school. Her contract was not renewed due to performance issues, and she sued the school. The Ninth Circuit declined to apply the ministerial exception in that case, instead limiting the ministerial exception to cases where there are clear religious titles or religious training, rather than looking at the function or the role that a particular person plays within a religious organization. Our Lady of Guadalupe, and that way followed the decision in St. James v. Beale. What was really unusual in that case is that you had a petition for an en banc petition for the Ninth Circuit to rehear this case. The court decided not to rehear the case, but nine judges on the Ninth Circuit dissented and criticized the Ninth Circuit's approach, pointed out that it was wading into a circuit split, and called for the court to fix the problem. Obviously, whenever you have nine judges signing on to a dissent like that, that's the sort of thing that tends to get the Supreme Court's attention. That split has only deepened since those decisions were announced. The California Court of Appeals, not to be outdone in Sue v. Stephen Wise Temple, decided to adopt the Ninth Circuit's approach. And so that's another case that is not a Beckett case, but that's another case that may be making its way toward the Supreme Court soon. After the Ninth Circuit made this decision, the Seventh Circuit, in a case called Sterlinski v. Catholic Bishop of Chicago, issued an opinion where the Seventh Circuit sided with the dissenters on the Ninth Circuit, criticized the Ninth Circuit's approach, and kept the Seventh Circuit in line with the Second Circuit, Fifth Circuit, and others who considered this issue. That was a Judge Easterbrook opinion. Again, when you have the circuits so clearly speaking to one another and pointing out the existence of a circuit split, those are the cases where the Supreme Court is very likely to become involved. And so I think it's very likely that the court will take up one or more of these ministerial exception cases this term. While I'm discussing ministerial exception, I want to mention a trio of cases that has already had some interest at the court, and some of you are probably aware of as well. They're not ministerial exception, but they do involve some sort of similar issues in terms of when are the civil courts going to get involved in religious disputes? When do you leave it to the religious authorities? And what is the authority of the courts to order various things with regard to religious organizations? The leading case, I'd say the case that at least has had most of the attention so far has been Diocese of San Juan versus Feliciano. This is a Paul Clement petition, and at the end of last term, the Supreme Court called for the views of the Solicitor General on this. This case involves Roman Catholic Church in Puerto Rico and some seizures and use of church property in order to fund pension liabilities on behalf of Catholic schools. And so I would expect that we'll probably be hearing something from the Solicitor General, perhaps by the end of the year, on what the recommendation is with regard to the Diocese of San Juan case. A couple of related cases to that. One is Turner v. Hines. Turner involves a Baptist church faction in which some members of the church sued in the name of the church and sought to receive injunctive relief from the court. It again raises questions of when and how the courts become involved in these disputes. Another case maybe headed to the court is Huey v. Presbyterian Church USA. It's Huey, H-O-E-Y. That case involves PCUSA doing some work with regard to church audits. They discovered some irregularities or failure to follow the rules. They then notified the relevant churches regarding this. Mr. Huey was a reverend who was then terminated as a result of those findings and sued the PCUSA for defamation. So again, raises questions of whether the ministerial exception should apply to that sort of situation and whether ecclesiastical abstention or church autonomy ought to apply. Given the number of these cases coming before the court and the court's interest and the clear circuit divisions, I would be surprised if the court does not take up one or more of these cases this term. I want to turn now to another case that Mark mentioned at the beginning. This also got a mention in the Linda Greenhouse article last week. And this is the case of Ricks v. Idaho. George Ricks is a general contractor in Idaho who has been denied the license that he needs to be able to work because he cannot, because of his faith, provide his social security number. He's willing to provide his birth certificate and alternative forms of identification so that Idaho can get the information it needs, yet the state has declined to accept that workaround. There is no Religious Freedom Restoration Act relief available for Mr. Ricks, either in Idaho or at the federal level. And so this case really tees up squarely the question of what standards should apply. Does the Supreme Court want to maintain the Employment Division v. Smith standard, which is very difficult to prove for religious plaintiffs, really puts a heavy thumb on the scale of governments in religious freedom disputes? Or does the Supreme Court want to, as four justices have suggested, revisit the Smith decision and reconsider? That is the question that's posed in the Ricks petition. The Supreme Court recently called for a response on the Ricks petition, so we will be seeing Idaho's response in October. I expect that in November or December, we will be learning whether the court is going to be taking up Mr. Ricks' case. I also want to highlight another case. We've discussed, and I've seen a lot of discussion about the Kennedy v. Bremerton concurrence, where you had four justices who said they might be willing to revisit Employment Division v. Smith. It's sometimes overlooked that there was a second decision that they said they might revisit, which is TWA v. Hardison. This is an older case involving religious discrimination under Title VII. It essentially made it very difficult for employees to prove religious discrimination under Title VII. It's a very employer-friendly standard that is employed more so than you see used in other sorts of discrimination cases. Patterson v. Walgreens is a case that was a petition that was filed last term that tees up this question. Daryl Patterson was a longtime employee of Walgreens. He is a Seventh-day Adventist who was unable to work on the Sabbath. He had been assured he would be accommodated, but there was a last-minute training that came up on a Saturday. Mr. Patterson was unable to participate and conduct that training. He was able to conduct it on Monday in time to meet the deadlines. No problems arose from that, and yet Mr. Patterson was fired for his Sabbath observance. He lost his case under Title VII because of the employer-friendly standard used in TWA v. Hardison, And now the Supreme Court is being asked how it would apply to WEA v. Hardison or whether it would actually revisit that decision in Mr. Patterson's case. Last term, the court called for the views of the Solicitor General on Mr. Patterson's case. And so we're expecting by the end of the year, we will learn more about what the Solicitor General is going to recommend with regard to Mr. Patterson's case and whether the Supreme Court will decide to take up this issue. I want to end by mentioning one more case that is back at the court again. As Mark mentioned, the Little Sisters of the Poor are again back at the Supreme Court. The contraceptive mandate dispute has not gone away. As many of you will remember, back in 2016, shortly after Justice Scalia passed away, the Supreme Court decided 8-0 to send the contraceptive mandate back to the government, back to the parties, to see if they could arrive at an approach going forward that would resolve the issues. In 2017, the Trump administration created new rules that exempted the Little Sisters and other religious objectors. Several states promptly sued over those new rules. The rules were later updated and finalized during the pendency of those lawsuits, and the final rules have since been enjoined nationwide. The state of Pennsylvania and the state of New Jersey are involved in one of those lawsuits, brought one of those lawsuits. The Little Sisters of the Poor are also involved in that lawsuit because they have homes in Pennsylvania and want to ensure that they can maintain their protection from the HHS mandate. Pennsylvania and New Jersey were able to obtain a nationwide injunction against these new rules protecting religious objectors. That injunction was upheld by the Third Circuit. An interesting wrinkle in these cases is that you have a proliferation of injunctions in places across the country protecting individual religious objectors from the HHS mandate. And those decisions are in tension with the decision that we've seen from the Third Circuit and from a district court in California enjoining the new rules that protect religious objectors. This issue has already been up to the Supreme Court twice in 2014, 2016, and looks poised to be headed there again in 2019 or 2020. The Little Sisters will be filing their cert petition soon, and I expect that later this fall we will be hearing from the court as to whether it's going to be taking up this issue. Those were the cases that I wanted to highlight. I know there are a number of others that we've listed on the handout as well that are worth watching, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Lori. For those who did join the call late, so that was Beckett Senior Counsel Lori Windham talking about the petitions at the court. We'll have time for just one question, and the question is from Lawrence Hurley from Reuters, and his question is, there have been a couple of recent lower court rulings in favor of individuals refusing to provide services to LGBT people based on religious objections. Does that mean the chances of SCOTUS taking up the Arlene's Flower case in the coming term have now increased?
Sure, that's a very interesting question. I think you're probably referring to the Eighth Circuit decision in Telescope Media, which protected a videographer in their free speech against some local anti-discrimination laws. And I saw just yesterday there was a decision from the Arizona Supreme Court in the Brush and Nib case involving some artists who did wedding invitations. I'd say Arlene's is not our case, so I hesitate to speak too much to that. But I think that what these decisions show is that the conflicts that have arisen regarding same-sex marriage and religious liberty since Obergefell have really continued to come up. They've continued to proliferate even since the Supreme Court's decision in Masterpiece. And so I think this places some additional urgency for the court to step in and to resolve these disputes before we see more and more cases across the country and more courts coming to different opinions.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We will make the recording available online shortly. If you have any follow-up questions, please contact media@beckettlaw.org to schedule time to speak with an attorney. Also, we do have a Supreme Court Cases to Watch document that we can send to you. It was linked to the media advisory this morning in the lead, but if you have not received it and would like it, please email media@beckettlaw.org, and I will send that to you. Thank you guys again. Appreciate it. Have a great day.